and I want to welcome you all very heartily to tonight's class on the Court of Pentacles. It's our last class of the year, and the last one in this year-long card study series. And I want you to know, for me, it's been a great year, and it's also been a real privilege for me to study with all of you guys. I really mean that. It has been such a pleasure, and it's been a challenge, and it's been an intense experience for me. You guys have been very sophisticated, very interested, very energetic, and you've pushed me, and I really appreciate that, so I just wanted you to know that. And tonight, what I want to do is I want to look at the Court of Pentacles in the context of court cards in general, so that, you know, even though we're looking at a specific court, we can take away with us an understanding of the entire process that is simultaneously flexible and practical and deep, all of those things at the same time. So if I can do that, I will feel that I've accomplished a great deal. Before we begin, though, does anybody have any questions or comments or observations about the Court of Pentacles in particular, or about court cards in general? Do you have any sense of what the cards are about, or any questions about this particular set of cards when you look at them? Anybody at all? Or do you feel in general, do all of you feel that when you look at these cards, you know what you're looking at? Martha, when you look at these cards, I'll ask each one of you in turn, kind of separately. When you look at the Court of Pentacles, you have them in front of you?
Yeah, I'm looking for them, but in my case, your question doesn't make any difference.
Okay, that's very funny.
I don't know the cards, and I'm new in this. So.
Right, okay. Well, I just wondered if you had a sense of what they were like when you looked at them. All right, let me ask you.
Sure. The sense that I get is the unknown is right in front of me.
Oh, good. That's a very nice perspective. I love it. Peggy, how about you? Do you have a sense of what these cards are about?
I guess I do, but not if I were reading them. I've never been comfortable with court cards as people.
Mm-hmm.
But, for instance, the Knight of Pentacles, it's the only card where the horse is not moving.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost as if the energy has come to rest in the final creation.
Right. Have you noticed that this is a dark horse, a black horse?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of odd why it should be a black horse, no?
I know the tower it descended into blackness.
Mm-hmm.
The blackness of...
Well, there's a reason for it. It's a fairly simple reason. It basically comes down to the fact that in esoteric parlance, earth, which is the pursuit associated with pentacles, one aspect of it is black. One of the color qualities of earth is black. So the horse is shown as black. Each one of the horses in the different suits is given a color dependent on the quality of the suit. You have the red horse in wands. You have the white horse in swords. You have the black horse here, and you have, which one are we missing? We're missing the cups. Cups is also a white horse, which is interesting. But in any case, that's a simple answer enough. Let me see. How about Francine, when you look at these cards, how do they feel to you?
Well, when I look at these, I have enough knowledge of them to include them in my reading.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, just to look at court cards, I have a hard time reading them because I never know if it's like a person in their life or if it's a personality.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard. Like, I look at all the other cards laying around them, but it's hard for me to determine just in
right.
general.
Right. But they could be one or the other, obviously.
Right.
And if they were, let's assume that for the moment a given court card was a person. If a king came up or a queen came up, you'd have a pretty good idea of what was going on if it was a queen of pentacles or something, right?
Right.
Good. And let me see, Kelly, when you look at a knight of pentacles, let's say, just we were talking about the knights before, do you get a sense of how he's different from the other knights?
Yeah, I think so. Peggy started it. Just the fact that he's still and you can kind of get a feel for him.
Mm-hmm.
I like the colors on it better too.
Now you're a woman and you feel you have the awareness of what it is to literally be a woman. And when you look at the Queen of Pentacles is what kind of woman compared to the other queens, do you think?
Calmer. I always see her as a lot more. I'm looking for a word. Don't give up on me.
Okay.
A lot more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Than the others.
So let's say that if I found the Queen of Pentacles in myself, because remember, all of these cards, in addition to being simple figures, you know, simple figures in our lives, like, you know, men and women or children or whatever that we know, they're also archetypes that have a presence in each of us. So if I were to find, you know, as a man, if I were to find the Queen of Pentacles in myself, how would it be? What would it mean for me? What would it mean if you were reading for a man and the Queen of Pentacles was about him?
Comfort at home, taking care of, very comfortable taking care of this stuff, of this life.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in other words, you could see readily enough how the figures, the combination of the rank and the suit, produce energies that you can find in anybody. You could find a Queen of Pentacles or even a King of Pentacles in, say, a little child.
Mm-hmm.
It's perfectly possible. Good. As long as you can see that, we have a beginning. We have a basis for discussion. Because if those things were not easy for you to see, then we would have a hard time. Peggy, when you look at these things, do you have any difficulty seeing them as typical responses in a human being in general, you know, regardless of their age or gender?
No, I don't. A man can be as nurturing as a woman.
Absolutely. Good. And a woman can also be as stubborn, as pig-headed, as authoritative, and whatever, as heavy-handed
now,
as a man.
Just because I'm Taurus, please don't.
Me too, by the way. I have a Taurus moon, so I understand. Okay. So anyway, that of course is another aspect of the cards. They all have astrological attributions and associations, and they tell us a good deal about the cards as well. So I want to start by pointing out that the court cards in general are subtle. They're very subtle, even though they may seem obvious. The things that we were saying come right off the top. You can look at the cards and kind of pick that up. But there's a lot of things underneath, and even why it is that these cards mean the things that we said they meant, where that comes from is an issue, and we've been talking about that all year, how to look at the pictures, the names, and the numbers, and from those basic symbols derive the pictures, the images that, you know, give us the information right off, you know, right without any study. So in this case, what we have are names and pictures, no numbers. And the names and pictures both seem to tell us together pretty clearly what we're seeing, and tradition tells us how to use them. You know, but there's always the sense that we're missing something. I mean, each of you that has mentioned it has said that there's a certain quality about the court card that doesn't sit altogether right. Not altogether comfortable. Or am I mistaken about that? How do you all feel about that? Kelly, do you feel comfortable with using the court cards in a practical sort of way?
Not always. Sometimes it clicks, but I wouldn't say it's consistent.
Okay. Peggy, you?
No, I don't.
Especially
it's related to people.
Okay. Martha, Martha, it's all kind of new, so I suppose newness would be the order of the day, and you wouldn't have an answer to that one. Francine, how about you?
I'm going to say no, too.
Well, you don't have to, you know, just because everybody else said, if you
sometimes
feel comfortable.
I kind of feel the same way about it, because like I said, sometimes I have a hard time reading so far.
Okay. Well, the reason why the court cards are actually somewhat mysterious, and the funny thing is that they're a lot more mysterious than many people think they are. Even the people who are slightly edgy about them and are not 100% sure what to do with them all the time, even those people don't know how actually difficult and complicated the court cards are. There are a lot more to them than you would think. And it doesn't show. You can't really see it. And that's because a court card, a tarot court card, is a compound in more than one dimension. I mean, it's not just a combination of suit and rank, although that's a big deal. And the suit and rank themselves are multidimensional, each one of those. And then there's a lot more besides. So what I want to do is look at the Court of Pentacles as a separate example of the first dimension of a court card compound. Now, a compound, you know, is basically a mixture of two things. And what we have here is, or a mixture of two or more things. And the first thing that this compound of our court card is made of is four separate human archetypes. And these archetypes, they inhabit and they express one of the four symbolic worlds that are indicated by the four suits. And the archetypes, of course, they're human figures who are the models. They're particular ways of responding to the world. And those ways of responding can be found in any human being. So the actual court cards are not limited to, although sometimes they point in the direction of actual human figures, human people. A human being, any human being, any man, any woman, any child, is made up simultaneously of all four of these things. And they all are active in you at any given moment. And that's a really interesting, you know, consideration. By the way, does anybody have an idea of what an archetype is? What do you mean by an archetype? We use that word all the time in relation to tarot, but there's a particular technical meaning, so to speak, to an archetype. Do you know what an archetype is? Anybody? Want to volunteer?
Pattern.
Huh?
A pattern.
A pattern, good. So a pattern is actually a very good definition or description, but it's not complete yet. When you say a pattern, in what way is an archetype different, say, than a pattern for a suit?
It's Reacher to try to pin me down.
I mean, would you call the pattern for a dress the same as an archetype?
If it were the ultimate dress.
Aha! So in other words, if it were an ideal dress, and this were the pattern for the ideal dress, it would be an archetype. That's interesting. That's pretty interesting. That makes it much more deep. So in other words, if you had a cat, but you were looking at the model of the ideal cat, the original model or design for a cat, that would be the archetype of a cat?
Well, all my cats think they're the ideal.
All right, but it's actually close, but not quite a cigar. Pattern, yes, but not necessarily based on an ideal. The ideal includes...
Well, it's all of something, right?
It's what?
It's all...
All of something.
Something. I'm just trying to describe it. It's hard, but like if you talk about the archetype of love, then it's...
Well, actually, archetype...
Love, it's absolute. No,
all right, now archetypes usually take on a shape. In other words, if you're going to, an archetype has a recognizable form. So, for example, they'll talk about the archetype of the old man, or the archetype of the shadow as an aspect of the personality, or the archetype of the fool, or the archetype of the village idiot type. The archetype of.
I see, but well, tell me something. But we can have human archetypes.
Yes. Are there any other kind?
Which represent human emotions. So
right.
We can have a human archetype of love, a human archetype of, let's say.
Well, what would be an archetype of love? What symbol or figure would be an archetype of love? Give me an example of such a thing. Because love by itself is simply a word describing a certain emotion or a certain, you know, relationship to the universe, but it's not an archetype by itself. That's a quality of life, but it's not an archetype. Well, I'm not going to torture you too much, because you could go around and beat around the bush with this a lot. I mean, I remember one time I was in a psychology class, a psychology 101 type thing, and our teacher was asking us questions like, well, what do you think neurosis is, right? And it's a word we use all the time. Person's neurotic, you know, we think we know what it means. And so we had like 40 people in the class, and everybody gave their ideas, and every single one of them was wrong, which is really very funny. And then, of course, the professor explained it, and there wasn't any trouble after that. But I'll give you the best of my understanding of it, and granted that mine is not a technical description that psychologists might agree with 100%. But basically, what you're looking at, as Peggy mentioned, it's a pattern, a template. But it has no substance. You can fill this template with anything. It's like a cookie cutter that you can use to cut any kind of dough with. You can if you take a cookie cutter, which is a pattern, out of that, with that cookie cutter, you can make chocolate chip cookies or vanilla cookies or oatmeal cookies or anything you want. The shape will be the same regardless of what you fill it with. So an archetype is a pattern or a shape that doesn't necessarily have an inner substance. You don't really. You could have the same archetype show up in Japan, in North America, in Africa, in Europe. The same basic archetype all, you know, would be in each and express the same pattern of response, of human response everywhere, even though in Africa you might find, let's say, a tribal leader, in Europe you might find a king, in Japan you might find a samurai, in North America you might find, you know, an Indian chief. Each one of these would be a separate kind of cookie dough filling the pattern. But the idea is the same. It's the response of the leader. So the archetype here, when we're talking about four human archetypes, these four human archetypes are not pictures, they're names. Page, knight, queen, and king in tarot are archetypes. They're cookie cutters. And you can fill that cookie cutter with four different kinds of dough. You can fill it with a pentacles dough, or a swords dough, or a cups dough, or a wands dough. Those are the four kinds that we have to fill those archetypes with. And each one is a different flavor, and each one has a different kind of nourishment and provides us with different nutrients. But that's what we've got. That's what you're talking about when you're talking about archetypes. So here we have these four, and in the case of the Court of Pentacles, we've got pentacles dough. So the question is, what kind of cookie do we make out of pentacles? What's the taste and flavor of the cookie we make out of pentacles? So let's say, for example, we took a page. So the flavor of the page of the flavor of every I mean the shape of every page is the shape of a page is young. And the shape of the page includes all the expected qualities, you know, childhood and early adolescence. I mean, usually you think of the page as only going up to a certain age. Regardless of how old a person is, there's clearly a youth, childhood, and adolescence in everybody. How many of you have known men, grown men, even older men, who have leftover adolescence in them?
Oh, my God.
Like, who doesn't, right? Okay, and in fact, it's one of the main complaints of women, I think, that men are oftentimes children in disguise.
Got it.
But the problem is, of course, that women, too, have the page in them. I don't care how old you are. There'll be the child in you, too. And the child shows up in many ways. So the archetype is the archetype of the child, and the page is that shape. Now, the knight, the archetype of the knight is an older, but still young person. But the difference between the knight and the page is the knight is filled with energy and direction, forward momentum. The knight goes forward, the knight moves in a direction, and is clearly male, whereas the page, you can't really tell by looking at the picture, although the essence of the page is to be female. Believe it or not, you may not know this, but tradition has the page as being female. But the knight is clearly male, and as an archetype, it's male. And he embodies the qualities that we think of as male, whatever those happen to be. I know that if we sat here and tried to establish what are male qualities and what are female qualities, we might have an argument or two. A lot of people get into gender war, you know, the battle of the sexes when it comes to describing those things. But because we know that every archetype exists in every one of us, we know that the male and the female and the masculine and the feminine qualities exist in us all the time, in each one of us in varying degrees, regardless of what our physical gender is. So that's the archetype of the knight. Now the queen is clearly older. And clearly, the queen is female. The pattern of the queen is an older female, more settled, more established, and, of course, clearly more authoritative than either the page or the knight. The queen sits on a throne, and the throne is a symbol of her authority. So we have, in the cookie-cutter pattern of the queen, age, authority, femaleness, and I guess those things, age, authority, and femaleness, and maybe some other things as well. Now the king is also older. The king is also established and authoritative, and the king is full of the power of masculine maturity. This is the mature man. This is the older man. This is the one who has arrived. Now the interesting thing is that there are children who have this quality, and I've met a few. Have you ever, anybody here ever met a young person who has a natural, inborn authority, maturity, and kind of settledness to them?
Absolutely.
And what do you think of a child like that? An odd kind of child, no?
Yeah, after you're over the startle,
uh-huh,
you can really grow to love them, but there's always a shock.
Right, and this is Kelly talking, and you're the teacher, so you have plenty of experience with that. How many of the rest of you have ever met a serious, competent, steady, a deep kind of child? Anybody? Anybody have relatives like that, or all the children you know, the wild and happy type? No, nobody's met this except for Kelly. Okay, that's interesting. You sure? Peggy,
yeah.
You've never met a child like that?
Mm-mm.
You have or haven't?
I actually never run into children.
Ah, okay.
So.
Well, let's see. Francine, how about you?
Yeah, I think that I probably met a few children that, and you're right, they do seem a little odd at first.
Mm-hmm.
That they're that mature, but.
Well, that's because, of course, the seriousness and solidness and depth of them is in contrast to what you could expect. If you look at a physical young person, You expect them to fit the mold of the archetype of the young person. You expect them to have the characteristic responses that go with their age and condition. So if there's somebody young, you expect them to act young. On the contrary, if you meet an older person who acts like a kid, that also is a little bit off-putting and startling, because you expect an older person to act older, and they don't always. And of course, also, as you meet, when you meet a person, they may put on the mask of a socially acceptable archetype. They may have the responses of, say, a serious, mature man when you first meet them. But when you get to know them, if you ever marry one of them, you may find that it's just a big baby once the mask is off. So archetypes exist on different levels. You may have several things operating simultaneously. In fact, they're all there operating simultaneously. You just have to know how to find them. So these are the archetypes, and they're types of response to the world. That's what they are. They're ways of approaching things, and they're found, as I mentioned before, complete. All four of these archetypes can be found all together in all of us, whether we're male or female, old or young. We can find them at this very moment, and we can find them in every moment of our lives. If you look at yourself right now, let me see. Martha, this is relatively new to you. The cards are new to you, and the process of tarot is new to you. But what we're getting at in this particular study is that not only can you use the cards to read other people, but you can also use them to read yourself. You can look at the cards and see yourself in the mirror of their meanings. Can you look at yourself and find the qualities of the knight?
In me?
Yeah.
Right now?
Mm-hmm. It may not be what's showing up right this second. It may not be the part that's close to the surface. But if you looked inside yourself, do you think you could find the qualities that you would associate with a knight?
Well, I guess if I start thinking, yeah.
Right off the top of your head, though, it doesn't come to mind?
No, I'm relating more to the queen.
Okay.
Than to the knight.
Okay, now the interesting thing is, of course, that right this moment you're a student, which puts you much more in the role of the page, and yet you don't recognize it. Is not the page the young person, the student, the one who learns, the one who's at the beginning of the path?
Well, but you asked me, who am I relating to right now, and I feel much more comfortable relating to the queen than to the page or to the knight.
Good. There it is. So the queen is there and operating fully now, and most close to the surface, where you can see her most, despite the fact that the others are there.
Right. I would have to sit down and think about the other two.
Okay. Let me see. Kelly? Can you find the king in yourself at this very moment?
Yeah, in other parts of my life I can.
In other parts of your life, absolutely. But right this moment, which of these four archetypes comes closest to the surface? Which one is operating most fully right now that you would recognize?
Right this second, it'd be the page.
Okay. Francine, how about you? Which one comes closest to mind?
The page right this second.
Okay. Now, do you recognize qualities of queen in yourself? Can you see yourself as a queen?
Absolutely.
Okay. Can you see yourself as a king?
Yeah, in certain ways.
You're married, are you not?
Yeah.
Okay. Does your husband ever have to deal with you in your capacity as king?
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay. It's something to think about. It isn't something that's obvious. But there are moments, there are flashes, when the king comes up in your face, it comes up in your voice, in your manner. Even if you don't normally occupy that position, there are times. Good. So, having established that more or less, I want to add to these archetypal figures, which are fairly complex, the additional aspect of ourselves that can be described by the symbol of the pentacle. Now, the pentacle is everything that is practical and solid, sensible and complete, direct, down to earth. These are the things that are usually associated with pentacles, and for good reason. When you say down to earth, it's because the suit of pentacles is associated with the element of earth, and all the things that are earthy have those particular qualities. Now, this is a layer, this earthy layer is something also that everybody has in them, no matter how philosophical or spiritual, no matter how emotional or intellectual a person may happen to be. Every single human being has a quality consisting of pentacles. Everybody has a body. Everybody experiences pain and pleasure. Everybody experiences hunger and thirst. Everybody experiences the senses, the appetites, the physicalness of things, the solidness of things, the hardness of things, and the separateness of things. So it's a layer kind of our innermost psychological and spiritual construction. Everybody's got it, you've got to have it. If you didn't have it, you wouldn't exist. If you had no body, what would you be? So the pentacles, it's a whole world of perceptions, a whole world of responses and experiences all by itself, and you have to put the two of them together. So now, if you add the qualities of this, you know, this practical, earthy world of pentacles to the individual nature of each of these four human archetypes that we were just talking about, you can begin to see why the names and pictures of the Court of Pentacles, they seem so clearly meaningful, why they're so suggestive. You can look at them, and they kind of give you a sense of what they are. This is only like a taste. And it may be that it's a more complicated thing, a more complicated way of describing something that, you know, than you would ordinarily think you would need. But does any of this seem, does this kind of analysis of the parts of the card, the elements of the card, does it make sense to you? Or does it seem overly, you know, analytical or maybe too complicated? What do you think, Francine? What's your feeling?
Kind of both. I mean, it makes sense that you would imply it that way, but it is complicated.
It is complicated. Remember at the beginning we said that one of the reasons why people tend to feel a little bit uneasy with the court cards. At least that seems to be the generality of things. Most of the people I know, including people who have titles of grandmaster, will say that of all the levels of cards, the court cards are the ones that give them the most trouble.
I can't get enough information out of them to be able to tell the person.
Right. Well, by the time we're done, I'm going to give you enough stuff, enough things to think about, enough elements that make up what a court card consists of, so that maybe once you see the principles of it, you can construct the meanings that need that apply and need to be considered. It's complicated. It really is. It's not so simple. For example, do you have in front of you, oh, say, a pen? Oh, never mind a pen. Do you have a telephone that you're listening to, right? And to use it, it's pretty simple. You pick up the receiver, you dial a number, you talk, nothing to it. Do you have any idea how many principles, how much mathematics, how much physics, how much philosophy there is in the making of a telephone? Do you know what you're holding? What you're holding amounts to something damn near tantamount to a miracle. And it's complex beyond most people's comprehension. It's simple to use, easy to figure out what to do with it, but to understand how it works and why it works, why it does what it does, and when things go wrong, what it is that might possibly be going wrong, that takes an expert. That takes school. That takes years of learning. And what we're doing here is taking an implement, which is, in this case, the court cards, and we are giving you here the beginnings of the miracle that makes them what they are, even though they look simple, just like the telephone looks simple. So you kind of maybe you even bit off more than you could chew. Maybe all of the things that we're talking about here are a steep hill to climb, and maybe a lot of effort, more effort than you would have thought. What do you think, Peggy? Is that true for you?
See, I love the analytical stuff.
Well, you're an analytical person. That's so funny. So for you, it's a pleasure, I gather.
Oh, for me, it's a pleasure, and I want to, you know, ask you 5 million questions on what this dot on that particular, you know,
right.
line means.
How about you, Martha? Is this more complicated than you would like? Does it push your limits or make you uncomfortable to do this amount of analysis and breaking down?
What can I do? Life is complex.
So you're willing to accept the complexity, even if you're not comfortable with it, or you may even like it, I don't know.
I'm surrounded by complexity all
Good.
Around me.
I am totally delighted that you're aware of that, because the world is indeed a very, very complex place. And when you deal with tarot, when you undertake to study tarot in depth and at length, you're undertaking to understand a great deal. And that means that you have to work. And good for you for accepting that. That's a great attitude, and it will actually allow you to go plowing right through this stuff. Good. Kelly, how about you? What's your response to complexity, subtlety, and maybe overdoing?
Well, the fact that we tend to break it down is a great relief to me. So,
oh, good.
I don't care how complicated it gets, as long as I can start breaking it down and then pulling it back together.
Good. I'm really delighted. Excellent. Okay. So now what we have here is, we mentioned the qualities of the pentacle, which we described before as, you know, earthy and practical and all that kind of stuff, and having to do with sensations and appetites and things. We described the qualities of youth and age, gender and maturity that we work with before with the court ranks. Now, if I asked you, Kelly, let's say, what is a queen of pentacles? What does a queen of pentacles mean to you? Not just a queen, but a queen of pentacles. What's that about for you?
Repeating myself, but
that
is somebody who's very comfortable with this body, this life, coordinating it, making it function, making it work, putting it together.
So this is a person who is comfortable in the world, comfortable with their body, comfortable making things work, and who naturally tends to bring order into things.
Right.
Good. So now, let me see. Martha, if you were to, now you are telling me that you are comfortable with the queen also, would you care to add anything to any of that in your understanding of the queen of pentacles in particular?
Well, not that I had made a direct relationship to me, but I look at her and she looks very poised, very accomplished, and I think, well,
good.
I guess that's a nice angle. That's something nice to say about myself.
That's right.
I only picked it up when I looked at the card.
You know what's interesting about this business of being poised and balanced and stuff? Take a look at the way she is, her posture. Which way is she looking? Francine, which way is the Queen of Pentacles looking?
She's looking to the left of the card, but she's actually looking down.
She's looking down. Why do you think she's looking down? What's that about? The queen is looking down.
She's reflecting?
Well, it could be. She certainly would have... the body language seems to be that. But there's a symbol in all this. There's a reason why she's looking down. She's looking down because Earth is down, and Pentacles is Earth. Now, the Page of Pentacles is looking up. Well, not actually up. Is the page... Which direction would you say? Or where is the page looking, Peggy?
Up at a... Yeah, he's looking up. Right.
Is he looking? Yeah, he's looking up, or is he looking out, or is he looking straight? Where is he? Where's his eyes? Where are his eyes focused?
It's focused on the pentacle in his hand.
Right. So now the interesting thing about that is that he's looking directly at the symbol that makes him who he is. He's looking at the pentacle. He's looking at something that he's holding in his hands. He's looking at something that his primary connection with is by touch. He's looking at something very close to him. There is the quality in pentacles of touch. Of all the four, of all the senses, pentacles is connected with touch, and it's very, very close. It's the most intimate, in a way, of all the suits. And so what the Page of Pentacles is doing with his gaze is looking very, very carefully at something that's very, very close to him. He's not looking far away at the mountains. He's not looking up at the sky. He's not looking around. He's looking directly in front of him at something that's right in front of his nose. This is the quality that we find in pentacles. You look at what's right in front of your nose. That's part of what makes a thing practical. I just wanted to point those things out to you, and then what I'm going to do is I'm going to allow you to consider what the gaze and the positions and the postures of the Knight and the King represent. I won't give you the answers to those. I'll let you think about that. But between the queen and the page, you get a sense of how to understand the body language and the postures, because they're not about ordinary body language and posture the way we see them in the everyday world. If you were to go to a book on body language, they would never tell you these things. They're specific to the symbol of the pentacle in this case. If you were looking at, say, a Knight of Swords, he would have a very different attitude and relationship to a suit symbol. The sword in his hand is very different than the pentacle in a Knight of Pentacles hand. They have a different relationship to their own suit symbol, those two, because the difference is in the suit itself. The Knight of Pentacles has a certain relationship to the pentacle, and that's shown in his posture. So I'm going to leave that for you as a mystery to contemplate. Now, let me see. In addition to those things, in addition to, you know, to the complexities of rank and suit, there's another layer of symbols, a whole additional level of responses that come with those. Not only are the court cards compound, they're complex. We mentioned before that there are dimensions, several dimensions to each card, and we're going to take a look at a couple of additional ones of those. Let me go to the idea that the court cards, in addition to rank and suit in general, as archetypes and levels of worlds, they're also a picture of the two social institutions of an actual court and of a family. None of us here have ever probably had much to do with a real court, a court that has a king and a queen and knights in them. There's still some of that left in England and possibly in a few other countries in the world, but we have not grown up with that. In fact, America was founded on the principle of banishing those things. So we don't have much of a real understanding or feeling for that here. If I were to ask the questions about a court of a person who was brought up in Britain, especially in the upper classes, they would know exactly what we were talking about very intimately. What exactly is a court? Something to consider. We're going to go into that in a little bit. A family is also not so easy to understand. There's lots and lots of layers and meanings to family relationships. But in addition to those two things, the court cards are also a picture of a hierarchy of time. They're the order of growth and actual, you know, kind of natural progression. There's a way in which things begin, get older, mature, and complete. And the court cards are a picture of that natural progression. Now that, in turn, is linked to the seasons of the year. I mean, you know that each one of the court cards, I don't know if you know this, but each one of the court cards is connected to one of the seasons. And they're also connected to the seasons of our life. Childhood, youth, maturity, and old age. And then there are the four directions, east, west, north, and south. They're the four elements of earth, air, fire, and water, and also of the four worlds, which some of you who have done some Kabbalah work with us have some familiarity with. All of those things are in the court cards and pictured by the court cards, whether you are aware of it or not. And then finally, they picture relationships between male and female, and between masculine and feminine. And there is, by the way, a difference between male and masculine and between female and feminine. Those words are used to describe slightly different aspects of the same thing. But you know all about these things already, don't you? No? You've all heard of the elements. You've all heard of the seasons, the directions, and the four worlds. I'm sure most of you have, anyway. Is there anybody here who is not aware that tarot is a conglomeration of connections between the four magical elements, the seasons, the directions, the, you know, the ups and downs, the worlds? Are you generally aware of that? Is anybody here not aware that those things are contained in tarot?
Well,
yeah.
If I can ask a question, I was aware of the elements and of the directions, but not of the ups and downs and the worlds.
Yeah, the seasons are there. There's a circle. You know,
the seasons.
Okay. So you know about the seasons, you know about the worlds, you know about the elements.
About the worlds. What do you mean by
okay,
that?
Okay, now in Kabbalah that's where you find the worlds. And the worlds are actually the source of all these other things. The seasons, the directions, the elements, the suits. Yeah, all of those things come out of Kabbalah, basically, and we haven't talked about that yet. So, although you know about those other things, you don't know about the worlds, we'll leave them alone. But some of you are familiar with that. Peggy, you are aware of the four worlds, are you not?
Uh-huh.
Okay, and Kelly, you too, right?
Yeah.
Good. Francine, I'm pretty sure you're not. I don't think you took that class with us, although you may have come across it elsewhere.
No, I know a little bit, but not enough
okay.
to understand.
So, in addition to their quality of rank, of age, and of gender, which the ranks are mostly made of, in addition to the qualities of the suit of pentacles, there is the family, the court, and all the magical principles of season and direction and beginnings and endings and the progression between them. All of those things are going on in the court card at the same time. Every single one of those qualities and levels and dimensions is working together to make the court card what it is. And again, that's why there's a sense of being slightly queasy. It's sort of like the earth turns on its axis to make night and day. It goes around the sun to make seasons. The sun itself moves around the galaxy. The galaxy moves around other galaxies, and all and a whole slew, a whole chunk of the universe moves around other chunks of the universe. It's wheels within wheels within wheels within wheels. So much movement, so many relationships, such complexity. But you're only aware of, here you are, you're sitting in your living room, or you're sitting wherever you're holding your phone, and you're not aware of these movements going on around you, are you? Are you aware of the turning of the earth at this moment, Peggy?
No.
No, it's going on. The earth is moving 1,000 miles an hour, basically, around itself. And it's moving quite a bit faster than that around the sun. And the sun is moving even faster than that around its pivotal point in the galaxy, et cetera, et cetera. The movements are huge, fast, like a slingshot going at enormous, you know, rates of speed. And they're only controlled by these amazingly subtle laws and mechanics. And all of this stuff is going on around you, and you're not in the least bit aware of it. The same thing is true with the court cards. All of this complexity, all of these movements, all of these laws and relationships exist between them. And yet, when we look at them, it looks pretty simple. So just be aware that to make that simplicity takes all of these interesting qualities. So what I want to know is, you're kind of all aware of elements, seasons, directions, worlds. You know about, you know, courts. You've heard about them anyway, and you know about families. You certainly know about male and female. And what I wanted to know was, before you began this class, did you have any idea that all of these kind of intensely significant and emotionally charged issues could be found in the simple names and pictures of court cards? Anybody have any idea that that was true? I'm opening up for you the kind of the quantum qualities of the court cards, the equivalent of the subatomic world that makes up these things. There's the in physics, of course, there's the big world, there's the macrocosm, the world of stars, the world of, you know, big physically complex, you know, events like oceans and tidal waves and winds and you know, and sunbursts and things, all the things that exist in the big world, they're controlled by laws and rules of nature that are on that scale. But if you really want to understand what the world is made of, you get down to the intensely small. Things that are so small they're invisible. And the laws of the invisible are called quantum laws. They're quantum mechanics, and they don't work by the same mechanisms that the world, the macrocosmic world works by. So I'm kind of opening up the door to an investigation of quantum understanding of the cards, a little bit different. And we're only going to be able to make a beginning here. There's obviously no way we're going to get to the bottom of it tonight. But we'll do what we can. We'll get as far as we can tonight and see what we can do. So the time has come to look a little bit more closely at this Court of Pentacles. And that way we can both deepen our sense of it, and we can also hopefully make more use of it. So what I want you to do, if you're not already doing it, is make notes. Lots of notes. They are going to come in handy. So I'm going to ask each of you some questions, and these are I'm going to ask you to make to pick between a pair of alternatives as to what you think Pentacles is about. And the answers are born of tradition. There's a reason why the answers are what they are, but you personally may or may not be in line with the tradition. Your feelings may be different. So let's see how that works. Kelly, what season of the year do you think Pentacles is associated with?
Winter.
Good. Winter is one tradition. It's not the only tradition, but it is one. Excellent. Does anybody disagree with that at all? Okay. Let me see.
There's a lot of yellow in there.
There is a lot of yellow in there, and there's a good reason for that. but we'll get to that later. The symbol of yellow is particularly important, and it actually does not coincide with winter at all. And there's a reason for that that comes from the organization of the four worlds, and there's a certain amount of argument between two systems of attribution, both of which have their purposes and a reason. Right now, what we're doing is we're sort of getting an idea of which of the various systems of attribution we're going to work with. It is true that the way we work at the Tarot School and the way many people work, Pentacles is associated with a season of winter. There is a way in which Pentacles is associated with a season of spring, and there's a reason for that, but we haven't got the ability to go into that because it's Kabbalistic, and if you don't already know it, there is no way to start talking about that now.
Oh, I would see it more as spring because of the yellow.
Absolutely, and you're absolutely right. The reason why that yellow is there is because of spring, absolutely. But we are going to still work with the idea that Pentacles is connected with winter because Earth, there's a reason. You'll see why. You'll see how it kind of hangs together as we go along. Now, I mentioned Earth, but so that brings us to the question, Francine, of what element you would associate with Pentacles. Left to yourself, without knowing anything from anybody else, what would you normally think Pentacles would be connected with? Of the four elements of air and fire and water and earth, which one would you think Pentacles was connected with?
I'm going to say, well, I know it's earth, but that's what I would pick even if I didn't know.
Okay, well, that's good. That's exactly good.
Far.
Yeah, fine. So does everybody more or less agree with that, or would you feel, does anybody feel intuitively that that Pentacles should be connected with some other element?
Is there fire?
Well, only because you're looking at the yellowness of it. But no, actually, the interesting thing is there is no fire in there. There is one quality that Earth, that the element of Earth shares with the element of fire, and we're going to get to that in a moment. Now, let me ask, Martha, which of the four directions of north and south and east and west would you consider Pentacles to belong to, traditionally?
North.
Absolutely. Good for you. Why?
I don't know. It was a guess. I don't know.
Good for you. It's an excellent guess. North is, in truth, it's actually what pretty much everybody agrees that Pentacles is connected with. It's connected with the direction of north. Okay. Kelly, which of the, what would you say between these two, is Pentacles hot or cold? If you had to make a choice just between those two.
Cold.
Good. Cold it is.
Definitely, yeah.
Absolutely. Good. Okay, does anybody disagree with that? Okay. Now, let me see. Peggy, would you say that Pentacles is wet or dry?
Dry.
Okay. And would you say that it is dark or light?
Dark.
Good. Now, guys, I want you to be taking notes here, because when you add all these things up, the things that I'm asking you here, when you've made these decisions and you write them down as a list, you're going to have a picture of Pentacles that you may never have seen before. Okay. Martha, would you say that Pentacles is slow or fast?
Slow.
Good. Would you say that it's thick or thin?
In between.
In between, but you have to pick one of them. If you had to pick between just those two, I mean, if those were the only alternatives you had,
you would
say that Earth is thin?
But there's a thickness to it that's why I said in between. It's not.
Okay, well, let's see. Then I will ask you again to pick. If you had to pick one quality that, remember we mentioned that this is connected with the element of Earth, and if that were true.
Okay, there's a thickness to it.
There is. What would you say the thinness of Earth, of Pentacles was? Just because the pentacle is a coin and therefore it has, you know, it's a thin thing?
I don't know. This is all very intuitive.
Okay, good.
But
the thickness is what is usually associated with pentacles, which is good. Francine, would you say that pentacles, if you had to make a choice between the two, is it volatile or stable?
Stable.
Good. Would you say that it is, subtle or simple? Well, let's take, instead of the word simple, let's use the word gross. Subtle or gross? Gross meaning, you know, again, not refined.
I'll say subtle.
Okay, why?
Because it's physical.
And would you say that if you were to, let's assume that for the moment you were to take of the various parts of the body, of the various parts of the psyche, the mind, the heart, the spirit, and the body. Which would you say Pentacles was associated with?
I'll say heart.
That's interesting. Anybody else have an idea? Everybody agree with that Pentacles is associated with heart?
Body.
It's the body, right?
Most often the tradition says that Pentacles is associated with the body, yes. Now the body, not only is it a physical human body, it's the body of everything. It's the physicality of things. That's another association with Earth. Now, definitely, physicality is subtle. It certainly is complicated enough. But it's not refined in the way spirit is refined or the way emotions are refined. So usually people would associate Pentacles with the simple or the gross or the unrefined as compared to the subtle or the refined or the high. So I'm going to give you that as simply a tradition, even though it's certainly open to argument.
What tradition is this
one? There is a basic root esoteric tradition, a magical tradition. And tarot, the kind of thing that we're doing with it now, with the kind of thing we're doing with tarot right this moment, is we're applying what amounts to a 600-year-old magical tradition to the different symbols that make up a tarot deck. These are things that were added to tarot over a period of time. They didn't start out that way. I don't think that it could be demonstrated that tarot had these things at its beginning. But over hundreds of years, tarot became the language of symbols for all of this magical stuff. And there was a tradition, a general root tradition, that made these associations. There are some arguments in the tradition. There's a couple of different branches. But these are pretty basic, and most people tend to agree with them. And they are the foundation of the pictures and the cards and the meanings that we've gotten used to. They're the reasons why we have the meanings that we have. So I can't say that they're absolutely correct. There's no absolute truth anywhere, I don't think. But these are the associations that are made by the magical tradition. And tradition has the advantage over individual perception that they've been tried and tested by millions of people over hundreds of years. And they tend to have the tradition eliminates to a certain extent the discrepancies that individual people have. They're tested by experience and by work. So that's why these things have a tendency to stand up and hold up over a long period of time. Talking about time, let's see. Francine, would you say that Pentacles represents beginning or end, if you had a choice? The beginning of a thing or the end of a thing?
Beginning.
You think of it as the beginning. Peggy, what do you think?
End.
You think end. Kelly, how about you?
End.
Okay. And Martha, how about you? What's your intuitive sense of Pentacles, beginning or end?
Sure, the end.
Okay, so we have three that say end, one that says beginning. Francine, why do you say beginning?
Because when we had the class, it's the spark of...
The spark of something was usually considered to be connected with fire. And fire is an element that isn't connected with Pentacles.
But when we had the Pentacle class, didn't we say that it was the spark of, like, a beginning?
No.
I know what you're saying about it being the end, too, because it's actually brought into, like, the physical...
Right, it's the...
Material.
Exactly. The material world is kind of the end of a process.
Right.
When we were talking, it's possible, I don't remember exactly in that class on the Pentacle whether we talked about spark, but one of the things that happens is that each one of the four elements has an ace in it. And each ace is in itself a spark in its own world. Each ace is a beginning in its own world, and each one of the four worlds, and that includes the world that Pentacles comes from, is kind of a breath. It's one of the breaths. You know how it was said that in the beginning when God made the human being, God breathed the breath of life into that being so that he rose from the clay and became alive? So supposedly there was this breath that God breathed into him to make him live. And the interesting thing about it is that from a magical point of view, there are four breaths. There's the breath of fire, a breath of air, a breath of water, and a breath of earth. And each one of these breaths is a beginning. So from a certain point, you could say that, you know, that Pentacles has in it a beginning. But if you compare it to the other four, if you compare it to the four worlds in general, to the four suits, it is actually the end of a process. The tradition holds that earth And pentacles as a symbol of earth is the end of things, not the beginning. So be aware of that. Even though you're perfectly at liberty to argue, you can have your own feelings about this, I want you to simply be aware of the tradition. And as we study maybe more over a period of time, I'll try to give you the thinking of the tradition that brought this into being. And even when I give you that, you may argue, and you may have your own point of view, and it's perfectly permissible and acceptable. But this is the tradition. Okay. Look what you've got here now. You've got Earth, winter, north, cold, dry,
midnight,
dark, midnight, slow, thick, stable, simple, and ending. What a combination of things add to have it combined in one simple symbol like a pentacle. And all of those things are true of all of the four court cards of pentacles. So, among the four ranks, among the four archetypes of the ranks, in the family, which one of these is the mother?
The queen.
The queen. So if the queen is the mother, which one would be the daughter?
The page.
Absolutely. And between the king and the knight, which one would you think of as the father?
Between the queen and the knight?
The king and the knight.
The king and the knight. The king.
Right, okay. So the king is normally understood to be the father, and that leaves the knight as the son. So what we have is a combination of mother and father, son and daughter. And so when you look at the queen, you're looking at not only a queen, you're looking at a mother with all the qualities of a mother. And if you were to sit down and write a book, actually many books have been written already, about what a mother is about, what the qualities of a mother are, and what the difficulties, problems, and challenges of a mother's life are. The same thing is true of each of the other family members. Now, let me see. Kelly, who in the court, we talked about the family to begin with, in the court, who would you say is the junior person?
Most junior?
Mm-hmm.
Page.
Okay. And in the court, who would you say rules?
King.
The king. And let me see, Peggy, in the court, who is the most active?
The knight.
Okay. And let me see, well then who would be the most authoritative?
The king.
Okay. Now let me see. I'm going to ask you a hard one, Martha. If you were to take two of them, if you were to put them together as pairs, which two would be the most sexually active as a pair?
The knight and the queen.
Excellent. Perfect. Which pair, Francine, would you think is the teacher and the student?
The page and... the king.
Absolutely. Your instincts are infallible. So now let me see. Peggy, who came first and who came last in this group? Which is the beginning of the suit and which is the end? And why?
Well, it would depend. Actually, the knight is the primal energy, so he would have been first.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
And the page is the final energy resting in earth, so he would be last.
How very interesting. That's a very interesting way of looking at it, and it's one of the bases for one tradition as to which element each one of the ranks belongs to.
Which one is the last?
Well, now, I'm not saying this was right. I'm just saying that she said the page was last and the knight
okay.
was first. But Martha, what would you say? Would you agree with that? Do you think in the order of progression, in the natural order of things, what's the start of the order and what's the completion of it? Who comes first in this?
For this group right here in front of us.
Uh-huh, yeah.
The knight comes first?
I didn't say anything. I'm not saying who. I'm just asking you what you're feeling.
You're asking me, right?
Yeah, I'm asking you. Which one do you think comes first?
Okay. So the knight comes first.
Mm-hmm.
And the king is last.
Okay, that's an interesting point of view. Why do you think the king is last? Okay, well, think about it. Well, the king is the oldest. And if you were to think in terms of a progression of time from the beginning to the end, And you were to think that the end was the finish, the completion, the last word on the subject. You would be right that the king would certainly fill that function. The king is the completed aspect of this particular court. He's the most knowledgeable, the most authoritative. He's reached the final peak of ability in this particular suit. But if that's true, if the king is at the far end of completion, and we're talking, the reason for that is his age, his maturity, then in that case it would be the beginning. Who is the youngest here?
It's the page, but I didn't see it in terms of age.
Exactly, you didn't. So you were right. You have a perfectly reasonable reason to see the knight as a beginning, the king as an end. That's a good way of looking at it. If you look at it from the point of view of simple age, if you look at it from the point of view of the cycle of life, when you start, you're at your youngest. When you finish, you're at your oldest. And the order of things would probably put the page at the beginning and the king at the end if you were looking at it from that point of view. So what we're seeing here is that there are several points of view. There's several ways that you could assess the progression, the natural progression from beginning to end. There are different kinds of beginnings and different kinds of ends, and each of them is legitimate. There is a good reason to assume that the knight is first. There's also a good reason to assume the page is first. Nobody thinks the king comes first, and nobody thinks the queen comes first.